This is actually, I'm not sure which is the worst time to present. First thing in the morning on the second day of a conference or right after lunch. But thank you, everybody, for getting up bright and early for this presentation. I am here presenting on behalf of a team of people at JSI on work that we've done over the past 5 years, particularly focusing on the needs of adolescents living with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. I was a bad presenter and didn't follow the rules, which is often my problem, and I forgot the slide about that there's no financial benefit to any of the work that I did, so I'm saying it orally, and I will try to correct that in future slides, and don't judge me for not having done that. So why adolescents living with HIV? Why is this an issue? As the slide here shows, there are about 2 million adolescents living with HIV. Adolescents, for the purposes of this presentation and for the work that we do, is the group of young men and young women ages 10 to 19 years old. Most recent estimates put that number at about 2 million adolescents living with HIV, 65% of whom are young girls. But you'll see that also that there's wide variations in the numbers of adolescents living with HIV by region, closely mapping with the adult prevalence. But one of the most interesting things here and the most important things here in this slide that I want to point out is that there are great numbers of countries that can't report anything related to adolescents living with HIV. They don't collect data and or information in age categories that relate to adolescents with HIV. So there is no way to actually adequately report whether there are adolescents living with HIV. Yes, I should turn my phone off. I am a bad presenter all around. Actually, the phone's in my the preponderance of adolescents living with HIV live in sub-Saharan Africa. So our work really focused on looking at sub-Saharan Africa and the challenges of addressing the needs of this unique population. But it's not to say that there are not also needs of adolescents in other regions of the world. And I'll come back to and I'll mention some of what those different challenges in other regions are a little bit later. But as it relates to sub-Saharan Africa, one of the big challenges, as I mentioned, is age and age definition. So UNICEF tried to cut this in multiple different ways and use different age points in their data. So some reports and some data report adolescents as 10 to 19-year-olds, and that is typically the direction in which people are going for a number of reasons. It's the chronological age of adolescence. It relates to the developmental status, and it relates to the agency, and as adolescents have more rights and control over their health-making decision, it represents an age and a transition period. But most countries report youth as 15 to 24. So that is a different age category, and report data and design programs for a different group of youth that starts later and extends into what we here in the West would consider into much further into adulthood, and skews also the numbers of adolescents living with HIV, because once you get past 19, it changes the numbers. Also, there's a unique factor here in adolescents living with HIV, because we have two significant ways in sub-Saharan Africa that people became infected with HIV in this category. The younger group, largely 10 to 15-year-olds, but increasingly older, were infected through perinatal infection. And this, for me, is somebody who's been in this field for 25 years. This number of 1.2 million kids in this younger age group is a good sign. If you told me 10 years ago that there would be 1.2 million 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old kids born with HIV who are alive today, I would have never believed you. This is a sign of our success, that we've gotten these kids on drugs, that they have successfully managed the drugs through the work of their family and their caregivers to survive into young adolescence is actually a testament to the work of thousands of people to ensure that they're alive. But that creates a new set of challenges for us as well. And then we have the burgeoning and exploding epidemic in young adolescents starting at 15, 16, particularly in young girls. Up until about the age of 15, the infection rates remain about the same between boys and girls. And then about at the age of 16, you see a great division where girls represent much larger numbers in infections. This is largely due to the sexual patterning that happens, sexual debut, and the fact that girls are often young, marrying at this age and having their first sexual activity, and often marrying at this age. So you're seeing much greater rates of infection in this population of young girls at this age. But this makes programming and making both programming and service delivery incredibly difficult when we can't even determine and decide on who we're talking about and what population we're talking about. So what were we doing? AIDSstar 1 was a USAID-funded project, 5 years, that was asked through the Africa Bureau at USAID to start thinking about activities in this area. And we had 3 major activities. The first was actually to convene a first ever consultation in sub-Saharan Africa of providers, family members, and particularly and most importantly, adolescents living with HIV to ask what's going on and what's important and what do you need. And so for 3 days in Botswana, 3.5 days in Botswana, nascent programs presented on what they were doing, but most importantly, adolescents reported on what was working and what wasn't working and what needed to happen in order to engage them in services and keep them in services. From that, we were asked then to develop a policy brief, and this was particularly targeting donors and government ministries of health and program designers. What were the program initiatives and the activities that needed to be put in place? Then from that, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in my presentation, we developed a transition toolkit. And this was particularly looking at that pocket and pool of adolescents born with HIV. How do you transition them in services from pediatric care to adult care in that period from 10 to 19 years old? And particularly targeting and understanding that there are different needs for the adolescent themselves, versus compared to the needs of the parent versus the need of the clinician. But how do you make sure that the information is linked and so that the messages are reinforcing each other? And then the last part that we did was look at a policy and practice. We did a mapping activity looking at adolescent services and policy in 10 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and that's what I'm going to spend most of my time presenting and talking about this morning. So, as you can see from this slide, we were asked to take on this policy review in 10 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Each of the blue dots represents one of the countries that we were asked to look at. The focus of the activity was to look at adolescent programming for adolescents living in HIV that really focused on 2 areas. Things that supported the new AIDS-free generation strategy being put forward by the PEPFAR and OGAC, but also aligned with national policies and strategies where they existed, particularly for adolescents living with HIV. This was meant to be an advocacy tool, recognizing that while there was a lot of talk and hoopla about the needs for adolescents living with HIV, there was very little evidence for the needs for that. There had been a WHO technical consultation on the needs for adolescents living with HIV, and very little of the programs had risen to a level to be considered evidence based practices to go into a WHO guidance. So there was a lack of evidence out there to talk about what was best practice and best policy, but something we needed more in the literature in order to guide people's understanding of what services were needed. And so this activity was undertaken to come up with these recommendations and look for ways of also integrating services, recognizing that adolescents living with HIV are not defined solely by their HIV status. They have far greater needs, and all too often what we do is first identify them as living with HIV, then adolescents, and then look at the whole host of other services that they need, and we need to look at that more holistically than that. So the way that this was done, we reached out to UNICEF, recognizing that they were really leading the charge in this and that we were going to have the best success and solutions if we teamed up with UNICEF on this effort. So working in collaboration with them, we did key informant interviews with PEPFAR offices, which included USAID, CDC, Peace Corps, Department of Labor, all the U.S. government agencies in country, and the UNICEF staff in country, and we did key informant interviews with them. And then we did online surveys with lead and international local NGOs and ministries of health about both policy and programs targeting adolescents and adolescents living with HIV, particularly looking at what policies were in place or the lack thereof, what activities were being done, both with donor support and private funds and or ministry funding, and then what cross-cutting initiatives were being done across ministries of finance, education, gender and women, and health. So a report was developed, and it's online, and I'll give that address at the end. And for each country, there is an assessment of what was the findings for each country. And then for each country, we've specifically talked about each of these technical areas. Focusing on what the policy and programs are in place, what donor and other support is in place, and what the opportunities are for better integrated services and a holistic approach to the needs and services for adolescents living with HIV. So 40 interviews were conducted with UNICEF and U.S. government staff from the 10 countries, and then we also heard back from 29 implementing partners and ministries of health in all 10 countries. In all of the countries, not one of them has a policy for adolescents living with HIV. At best, it's buried in a broader strategy of adult care or pediatric care, but there is not a standalone, freestanding policy and program and goals and objectives that are addressing the needs of adolescents living with HIV. This is either for pediatrically infected or for adolescents who acquire HIV during their adolescent years. Some are in the process of developing that, and some are just thinking about it as a good idea at this point, but there's nothing right now guiding the national response in any of these 10 countries, but all recognize that it is something that they do. There's no consistent definition of adolescence across the countries. They all have a different definition, and it also varies by not only age, but it also varies by marital status and other criteria within countries. And also importantly, the age of consent for HIV testing and also for access to medical services varies greatly. As you'll see in this slide, age of consent, the adolescent age definition can range, start anywhere at 10 and go to 24, and in some countries adolescence doesn't start till 15. So as I mentioned earlier, this makes programming very difficult. So in Uganda, adolescence is only that period 15 to 19. So that means there are no real defined services for anybody 10 to 14. It means no sexual and reproductive health services, no specific HIV services for anybody in that group, and no specific transitioning services for adolescents living with HIV in that group, because they are not defined as a separate group. They're considered part of pediatric care at that point. Age of consent also varies widely. So you can be in 18. So in Tanzania and Uganda, two countries that are heavily hit by the epidemic, you need a parental consent up to the age of 18 in order to be tested. South Africa is leading the way along with Malawi and Kenya and a couple of others. At 12 and 13, an adolescent can add consent without their parents' consent. But in a number of these countries, a young woman married needs her husband's consent. So this further complicates the process and the story, and then what is not here, but it also further complicates the story. If you test positive, in a number of countries, there is then a separate consent process, and children under the age of 18 can't access medical care without a parent's consent. So you could have gotten an HIV-positive test result, but you can't access medical services without your parents' consent. So this further complicates agency and autonomy for adolescents to manage their own HIV care in a number of these countries. And then for the program planner and for the ability to plan the activities, look at the wide variety of age disaggregation. So in Kenya, you look at 0 to 15 and 15 and older. That's how they disaggregate the data. So, or in Malawi, it's 18 months to 14 years old, 14 to 24. Now, if you were a program planner at the national level, how are you going to make decisions about how to program activities for this population that has significant needs that change wildly? Let's not even talk 10 to 14, 14 to 19. That's probably not specific enough. But these are almost impossible to do program planning against. In Uganda, doesn't even specify. So how you do program planning in this environment becomes incredibly difficult. In prevention, the study findings were that most prevention activities are focused in school-based systems, but teachers are largely not well-trained. They get 1 to 2 days training in doing prevention activities, and it's already being loaded into an overextended curriculum activities in the school system. They're often skills-based and don't address the needs of particularly key populations, including girls and young women forced into sex work and also key populations, including people with substance use problems and those young boys engaging in same-sex behaviors. They are also often typically not linked to broader initiatives and activities, and as you can see, one of the concerns about the school-based prevention programs is that they also don't tend to link to HIV testing and counseling programs or any of the other subsequent services. So even if the service and the messages get through that you're at high risk for HIV and you need to do something, the curriculums don't then point people to where do you get services, and there are typically not school-based HIV testing programs and initiatives in most settings. When you look at health services, and there are increasing models of having youth-friendly services in centers, but they are not overly well used, and they are not they are often held at times when youth can't actually use them. One tremendous success that is out there is the scale-up of voluntary male circumcision. That has been a tremendous uptake among young men and young boys of this service, and is seen as a real success story. Transitioning of adolescents living with HIV into adult care is something that has to happen as we move forward. As you can see from this quote, it's not just the clinical care, but it's also the social services and all sexual and reproductive health and substance use and a whole range of services that are needed for adolescents living with HIV. Clinicians and providers report that this is a place that is incredibly difficult for them. They can manage sometimes the clinical aspects, but all the other wraparound services they don't feel adequately trained to be able to provide. And that thinking about a 10-year plan of transitioning is not something that most providers are trained in how to think through and how to come up with an action plan to build resiliency and self-reliance is something that is beyond the scope of what they've been trained to do. So we helped and developed a toolkit for transition that has been field-tested in Mozambique and Kenya that targets the adolescent, the parents, and the care provider. And it focuses on not just clinical care, but sexual reproductive health, substance use, grief and bereavement, beneficial disclosure, adherence, with the goal towards building self-reliance and the ability for adolescents to manage their own HIV care over time using developmental benchmarks rather than age as a guide for transition and helping to build a transition pathway that engages both the parent and the adolescent in development of that plan. Each of the modules can be done based on what the adolescent's need is at that specific time and space. There are lots of opportunities for integration, the report found, in a number of different areas, including education, integration with primary health care services, social services, particularly a glaring need is around post-rape care and how to integrate HIV services into post-rape care that target adolescents. In a number of countries, and the report has this, we've highlighted innovative programs that are being done in countries. So in a couple, the sister-to-sister program, it's looking at targeting programs for girls 15 to 18 and building life skills for that specific population, so very narrowly targeted and guided for that population, realizing that is needed for them. In Mozambique, it's a variety of different programs that are focusing by being done by different ministries, so both the Ministry of Social Welfare, Ministry of Youth, Ministry of Health. So this was a perfect example of where ministries are coming together, and it's not just solely resting on the Ministry of Health to address the needs of adolescents living with HIV. And in Tanzania, there was a particular focus on how to address loss to follow-up through the teen clubs, because the loss to follow-up was a particular challenge in Tanzania that was seen. So this report then also came up with recommendations, and you can see them here. The most important ones that we saw were addressing the ages of consent, that if adolescents can't consent for services, they're never going to come into services. How to define adolescents and disaggregate it, and how to streamline collaboration. But for me, one of the most important things is we have to involve adolescents in this. I've been in the HIV field for 25 years. I'm a person living with HIV. We seem to have lost that pathway that we've been engaged in all along. You cannot design services in support of people if they're not sitting at the table. There's so much that is done by proxy for adolescents, and we're not inviting them to sit at the table. And then we are confused and befuddled when they don't actually show up for services or they don't remain in care. I don't know why we're shocked about this. We've learned they need to be at the table. They need to be and the table needs to be reconfigured and redesigned so that they feel welcome to both come there and stay at the table. The other recommendations are here, and they're in the presentation. You can find all of these and a lot more materials on our website, aidstar-1.com. There are over 800 different materials around HIV, focusing on resource limited settings. There is a specific tab around the work that we've done with adolescents living with HIV. Thank you for your time. Thanks for coming out at 8:30 in the morning, and I will turn it over to the next presenter. Thanks.